This is Gem Archer, and you're listening to the Stage Left podcast. Fucking, fucking one.
Didn't ask you to write it down or anything.
Hi everyone, this is Chris Simpson. Welcome to the Stage Left podcast, part one of two with YC from Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds. It was such an in-depth interview, we just couldn't cram it into one episode. So, you know, you'll hear about her working with the likes of Brian Eno and working with the likes of Noel Gallagher, Damon Albarn, Tony Allen, who's like a legendary Afrobeat drummer, and loads more. And YC is actually centres a bit of a world exclusive that we're going to include in part two, which is her cover, recorded in the studio of Noel Gallagher's song The Right Stuff, so you'll hear that in part two. And YC joins like a long list of kind of Gallagher related artists if you're into that kind of stuff. So you just heard from Gem there, and we've also had on Mikey Rowe, Russ Pritchard, which recorded in Rome, and Jess Greenfield from Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds, and from the other side of the fence, if you like, Dan McDougall, which we recorded in Barcelona, and Christian Madden from Liam's band, and their brother Paul, actually, who talks about in quite a lot detail about growing up with Liam and Noel. Upcoming events we have coming up. So if you are UK based and listening to this at the point of release, YC is going to be playing our night that we run at the Groucho Club on the 27th of January. Send us a message on our social, so search for the Stage Left podcast, and Stage Left is all one word, and we'll put you on the guest list for that. And we've also got an event, some of you know that we run the supper clubs in our lounge, Stage Left Nights. Jess from Noel's band has played one before, and Jess is going to be doing another one in the new year. Date to be confirmed, but go on our socials to find out and stay in the loop. But essentially what that is, it's a 5-course meal in my house, cooked by my partner, Davila Jay, who's an award-winning chef. And between the 4th and 5th course, when you're sat with Jess, she'll pull the stool back and she'll play a few songs for us as well. It's an amazing intimate night, and there's only room for 10 of us, so it's a great night. So upcoming episodes feature Susie Webb, who was backing vocalist for The Who for the Quadrophenia shows, and does such an interesting dive into her career that with she doesn't hold back with any of her stories. My jaw was on the floor all the way through the interview, and I was belly laughing throughout, so that's coming up. That's a really, really interesting one. And also, just to state, we were very lucky, very privileged to be invited to Clive Deemer's wedding on Saturday. Clive and Lisa have become friends of ours since they appeared on the podcast last year. Clive is the live Radiohead drummer, and was in Portishead and Robert Plant's band, and there was such an incredible array of faces there, and spoke to a few people throughout the night, and when I checked my phone the next day, I'd had a couple of email addresses of people who were a bit, you know, who'd heard of the podcast and wanted to come on. So the likes of Jeff Barrow and Ed Harcourt are people who I believe are going to be coming on in the new year, so plenty to look forward to. Enough from me for now. Let's pass over to YC from Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds. Okay, welcome to the Stage Left podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. The podcast exists to provide free educational content for young musicians entering an increasingly complex industry by telling the stories of some of the unsung heroes behind the success. Go to thestageleftpodcast.com for all episodes featuring musicians who discuss in detail the recording, writing and performing processes of the likes of Elvis Presley, David Bowie, Michael Jackson, The Beatles, Fleetwood Mac, Nick Cave, Oasis, Morrissey, Alanis Morissette, The 1975 and The Stone Roses. Today we're joined by YC, who sings with Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds, and they're about to embark on a tour of Thailand, Australia and New Zealand supporting U2. And today we'll be discussing working with the godfather of trip-hop, James Lavelle of Uncle, the godfather of Afrobeat, Tony Allen, the godfather of production, Brian Eno, and singing joint lead vocals with a man we all wish was our godfather, Noel Gallagher. We'll also be discussing YC's truly special solo material, supporting Smashing Pumpkins across the US, and comparing and contrasting how Damon Albarn's approach to performing differs from Noel Gallagher's. So it's a pleasure to say that our guest today on the Stage Left podcast is none other than YC. Thanks for joining us today, YC. How's it going?
I'm good, thank you.
Good. So you've just finished packing for what's coming up. So you've got a month tour, is that right?
Yeah, literally finished packing right. I mean, it's never finished, actually, until you have to go to the airport. Oh.
So how does your approach to preparation on the day of a concert differ when you're playing a support slot compared to a headline slot?
It doesn't change at all. Yeah, I mean, you can't just thinking, oh, I'm supporting, so I'm doing less than when I'm headlining. It's every day the same. I mean, whether you are in a bar singing or in a stadium with you two, for me at least, might not be the same pressure, but I think it might be the same actually. Mm-hmm, yeah. It's always a preparation, and it should be the same, I think.
It's interesting. Russ, when he asked him that question, said massively. He actually said it massively changed. All the preparation of the day, he said there's less pressure on, and so it was kind of a case that he could relax a bit more and then have a drink afterwards. So it's kind of interesting to see the different dynamics.
For me, any time when I have to perform, and even become, you know, before coming here, I'm not stressed, but I always have, you know, I don't anticipation. I don't know what's gonna happen. I like the fact that I don't know what's gonna happen, but that's what keeps me going, you know, on my toes, and never like, you know, this is a small thing or this is a big thing. No, everything, you know, has its own importance. So yeah.
And you've been rehearsing all week, is that right? In
Battersea? Yes, yeah. Yes, yes.
How's that been going?
Yeah, great. I mean, you know, we know the song now by the time. There's always new things, which is great, which keep us, you know, going. Because, you know, Noel has been releasing a lot of new songs all the time, like this year. So we always, you know, start new things. But yeah, I'm not directly concerned because I'm not doing the whole set. But yeah, it's still, you know, enjoyable.
And what's been the biggest challenge for you this week? Is because you've only just really got back from doing the tour with Smashing Pumpkins, mm-hmm. and now you're going out again. I was surprised to see you doing this much rehearsal. Like, could you have just turned up and just played these shows without rehearsing? Or
I think we could have like one sound check there and go for it, because, you know, it's been 2 years in a row we are, you know, doing. But yeah, I think Noel needs it, and we found out that we also need it at some point, because, you know, the more we do, the more we are three, in a way that, you know, you don't have to think about it sometimes. So whether it's raining or there's a storm, you can still do it, you know, eyes closed. And so yeah, that's kind of, that makes it more comfortable, I guess.
So Tony Allen was Fela Kuti's drummer, and Fela Kuti was described as being very, very strict about rehearsals. Mm-hmm. How does a rehearsal for one of your solo shows compare to an Noel Gallagher show? Would you have that many rehearsals beforehand, or do you like to keep it loose? Or
I think I'm the same actually. When I think about it now, I'm kind of, yeah, I'm exigent. I'm really exigent. In myself and with others, I guess. You want to give your best, and somehow maybe it's an OCD thing, I don't know, but you need to make sure you are okay. And sometimes you overdo it a little bit, but I mean, you know, does it matter to do more if you make sure that you're fine, you know, and you are comfortable. So yeah, if we can do it, we do it. I mean,
and on the day of a show, what's your preparation to get into the zone to be ready? What do you need to be in place so you're happy that you're going to perform at your best?
Yeah, first I need to have a good night, I guess, before.
Sleep.
Okay, yes.
Not a night out.
Yeah, no. Good night, sleep. Sometimes it would be a night out, but I will just have to make sure that even the few hours I have are deep. Wake up, have a nice breakfast, go to the gym, do some sport. I will go for yoga, stretching, always stretch anyway, obliged, like I have to stretch.
How does yoga help with your performance? In which ways does it
help? I mean, it's all about breathing. So singing is about breathing, talking is about breathing, everything is about breathing. So if you can remind yourself to breathe deeply, an hour at least, you know, in your day, or even 30 minutes or even 10 minutes, that makes all the difference. I mean, I can see how my days are without and, you know, with, and it's totally different.
Really?
Yeah. And when you start to do it a lot, you it's an addiction, because you realize that, you know, in India, some Buddhists will tell you that we have a Western idea of what is yoga. Like, go to yoga once a week. For them, it's ridiculous. Like, oh, so you're breathing deeply once a week. Right. Good luck, you know. And so, yeah, I'm, you know, I'm not going to be a hypocrite and say that I can do it every day. I can't. Sometimes the flights are early. Sometimes I'm lazy. Sometimes I'm tired. Sometimes it depends also of, you know, the shit we have. But
And is it difficult to find a place to do it, or do you do it in your hotel room?
In my hotel room, my hotel room for sure. And if I can, I go to the gym at the hotel.
And so you don't need a teacher. So have you got your own routine that you do, or do you get up a YouTube video or something like that?
Sometimes I do. There is this girl called Adrienne. Yoga with Adrienne.
Okay, great.
She's great, and I talked to Jess about it, and she did it also. She's great, and she has like a really sweet voice and a smooth way to teach the yoga, and the videos are great. So yeah, I will advise
That's
everyone.
Amazing.
Yoga with Adrienne. It's like 25 minutes, 30 minutes sessions, and it's really sweet.
And so once you've done your yoga and that's helped you, what else needs to be in place for you to be really happy to have a great performance in the evening?
I guess, yoga, meditation, just make sure that everyone has their own way to meditate. I'm not going to say that, you know, I just did the whole thing like the way we see it. Sometimes it's just, you know, stop and with myself and just realize that I'm... Just remember that I'm grateful for where I am, what I'm about to do. For me, it's a lot about being grateful because I am, because it's I have a crazy life at the moment in the best way. And you need to remember that, like, each second. Otherwise, you don't enjoy it. Otherwise, it becomes normal. And I don't want it to become normal. It's amazing, so...
So the grateful thing is really interesting. So there's a guy called Dr. Daniel Amen who he did brain scans of 85,000 people, and he kind of did this study that said if you say identify three things you're grateful for every day, after 2 weeks you get a higher rise in your dopamine levels than you would do if you were given kind of Prozac, which is like an antidepressant.
Yeah.
And so, like, saying, you know, identifying things you're really grateful for every day is like a really good thing for mindfulness. Cool. And then in regards to when you... Do you use in-ear monitors?
Yes.
So what's the mix that you are asking for your...
Oh, I guess I have a bit of everyone. I have a bit of everyone. Just don't put the drum too loud because Chris is already like very energetic person. So I don't need it that much. But a bit of everyone actually. Yeah. But mostly, I guess, the vocals, the bass.
What do you pitch to? Do you pitch to Russ's bass, or do you pitch to get the right to Noel's voice, or
a bit of
everything?
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Okay, so your aunt brought you up in Marseille, is that right? Your auntie brought you up in Marseille, is that correct?
I mean, I was born in Draguignan. It's like an hour from Marseille.
Okay, cool. Yeah. And you did a psychology degree in Paris, is that right?
No, in Aix-en-Provence,
South. Yeah. Oh, okay, in the South, okay. And I'd be interested to see, do you think there's any correlation between the success you've had in your career to doing a psychology degree?
I think... It might not be nice to say, but I think it's true. We all are... healing from something by making music, doing music, and sharing it with people. I think so. From what I see around me, from where I'm coming from, we are all, you know, healing something by giving back or giving back to ourselves. I think, and music is a really smooth and sweet way to heal. I guess, you know, psychology has been a very, very important for me. Like, studying it for me was a way to understand myself also, I guess.
What did you learn about yourself?
I wouldn't know. I shouldn't know. I wouldn't know how to start. I don't know, just that there are some schemas repetitive kind of schemas of behaviors, and that you can, you know, break them and go to some other schema that makes you more happy if you're not happy, first of all. So you have to recognize those shame, at first, otherwise you can't change them. And then change them is a work. So that's what you do with psychologists. But there's different kind of therapies. And that's why I stopped my courses, because I was not agreeing with all the kind of therapy.
Interesting.
Yeah, for me, the long one with, you know, staying 10 years, just like going back into the deepness of, you know, of everything that hurt you. I don't believe in that one. I believe in a brief therapy that say, okay, you're not obliged to talk about everything that happened. If it comes up, it comes up, because mm-hmm. it has to. Otherwise, some people can deal with like shit that happened to them really well. Some are going to stay on this, but you know, not everyone is the same. So I wouldn't understand why there would be like one recipe, and that they were trying to teach me one recipe, Freud or one other. And I was just like, I don't see it this way. I see like many, many, many other possibilities, as much as we are of human beings, you know. So, yeah.
So did you finish your studies, or did you?
I quit it the last year. Like, I was at 1 year close to open a psychologist, you know, like.
So the reason cabinet. I'm pulling this face, so I, at Sussex University, I teach psychology in the way humans learn. I mark people, and the way they get the best mark, so little secret here for any students here, is to come up with an original idea that challenges the pre-existing ideas. So it's almost like you got to the end and you thought, actually, I disagree with this. And that's right. Let's write, what should it be? And then like that would have got you a really good mark. Yeah. So go back to your studies and do it at some point down the road, because your ideas are absolutely as valid as anyone else's. And you could change the way in which people think about these ideas, because it didn't work for you. So
sure.
And they're the people who do that are the people who get first and distinctions and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Cool. So that's really interesting that kind of psychology is still on your radar.
Yeah,
how has it helped you in regards to performance in any way? Does it help you in your performance, getting you into a zone or anything?
Yeah,
or
I guess it helps me for the stress. It helps me to, you know, to canalize the energies when, you know, or someone else's energies when it comes to you. You know, it's a crazy world. Like we have like a emotional lift all the time. You know, you're going to play a show that's very important, and every other musician is going to see it, and there's a great big crowd and audience, and you have a responsibility, especially when, you know, you are doing solo, but you're also working with, you know, Noel Gallagher. You can't really fail, you know. So of course you're gonna fail. Fail doesn't, you know, it's not.
But failure and success is subjective.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly, subjective. But yeah, it's really subjective. It depends on where you are at. But you know, you have pressure. So it helps canalize that. It helps understand other people. It helps not to, you know, hate people. Trying to understand them more, being more compassionate and more, you know. And sometimes it helps avoiding them also.
Yeah, yeah.
With some people.
That's a great tip for stress, right? So if you've got someone who's stressing out your life, avoid them.
Exactly.
Like, get them out of your life.
You can't stay around, like, you know.
If possible, that is. So what's one of your biggest kind of strive? So I remember when I interviewed Jess, she said her biggest kind of drive in a career and what she kind of strived for was to make her parents proud or make her family proud. It's very different for different people. So what drives you? Is that coming from a similar place or a completely different place?
I think I've been inspired very quickly by other singers, other people, not only singers, but, and I guess I somehow want to do the same. Like, sometimes I receive messages from a mom who say, oh, my 3-year-old daughter wants to start some singing class, and it's because of you, it's because she's seen you there. And 3 years old, it's I remember, even if it's really early, that it was the age where I started singing all the time at home, and everyone was like, oh my God, she's she, you know, we can't sleep anymore. And I guess I want to inspire as much as I can, but not in the way that I want to be this person who inspires. Not in a, it's just that I think it's super important to have people that show you that it's possible. Mm. I was lucky enough to have some people, so I just, you know, by doing what they did and doing it my own way and on my own path, and I wanted to continue, you know, like that's what we do, I guess. Just and then it's a healing also, like I said, process. When I was young, I was born with like some health issues, and that's why I had to stay in France, because I couldn't go back to Africa. I think it was somehow way to, you know, when I started singing, I think I remember somehow what it felt, and it felt so good that I couldn't stop, and somehow it helped me a lot, I think, overcome all the hospital things, or, you know, all I had to go through as a kid. So that was the saver.
And how does it help you now?
It's the same.
Really?
I mean, you know, singing by itself is just aligns your everything, and just put yourselves in the best happy, you know, position. So it might be a bit difficult to understand, you know, but yeah, it's what it does. It's just, and then to add music on top of that, good music, good musicians, that's just music. Okay, that's where I'm going. I want to do that all my life.
I agree. I think for people's well-being, having a creative outlet is so, so important. Exactly. And a really interesting thing, I did some work with an amazing charity called Musicians Help UK, and they were speaking to one of the counsellors there, and they said they get a lot of people call up in their kind of 30s to 40s who have had kids and are not doing music quite so much. And one of the first things the counsellors say is, are you still playing gigs? And they say, no, I haven't got time to, you know, playing concerts. Or I'm not, you know, I've got to take kids to school. And they say, start playing some gigs, even if you play to an empty room and no one's there, or playing in whatever it is, creating some music and having that creative outlet is so therapeutic for people. So it's really important that we do that. Cool. So I'd like to talk about some of the people you've worked with that really kind of opened my eyes to you. So I'm going to quickly tell a story that I was in Brighton about a year or so ago, and I was staying at an Airbnb, you know, like what an Airbnb is, like a hotel or someone's house. Yeah. And it was this very eccentric woman who answered the door, and very arty, and she had some amazing artwork everywhere. And I started talking to her, and she said, oh, how come you're in Brighton? And I said, I'm doing some music stuff. And she said, my son is a musician. She's very modest. And I thought, oh, right, okay, well, son's a musician. And then she started bringing out some stuff that had uncle written on it, UNKLE. And I thought, okay. And I realised her surname was Lavelle, and it was James Lavelle's mum, basically, who was running this Airbnb. And she gave me this incredible thing, which is on the back of my door, which I'll show you in a moment, which is Rabbit in Your Headlights, which is a song that Tom York from Radiohead did with uncle. And she gave me this print to take home, and I've kept it ever since. And I'm amazed that you've worked with uncle. And actually, how I first heard of you is you did a song called Cowboys or Indians, which we actually said about 2 years ago is like our in our top like three songs of that year. Absolutely beautiful song. Please tell us a how you got involved working with uncle, but also he's very well known for being with his collaboration, so he does a lot of collaboration. So what did he do to get the best out of you in those performances?
I've met him because I was going to sing with a girl called Eska, a great singer, by the way, from the UK, that I've met earlier with Tony Allen. So she asked me to come and sing with her in Paris for the fashion, for a catwalk for Rick Owens. So it's okay. A fashion designer, yep. Great designer. And so I love the project because we had to do a 15-minute piece of, during all the catwalk, we will sing without stopping. So it's a 15-minute song, basically, that doesn't stop, ever. And the arrangements were done by James. So wow. James was there playing live with machines and all that, and we would be singing in some kind of cage, and the models were there, like, you know, doing their thing. So that was a crazy wow. moment, and I didn't know of James before, but we met that day, and it was amazing. We were three singers. It was like so beautiful, such a, you know James. So it was like a real beautiful piece of music. First time ever in my life that I have to sing for 15 minutes without stopping.
Really?
Without stopping at all. So, yeah, that was a challenge. I love challenges. So, great. And then after the show, James was like, oh, I'm going to do this album next year. So the road part one. I love you to be in there, Eska. You know, that would be great. And so, he called me by the end of the year, that year, and said, yeah, come to my place. So basically we did everything we did in his room, in one of his room of he's got a little studio at home, and yeah, it just happened like that on a Sunday night between 9 and 11.
Because you did three, I think you did about three songs,
yeah,
is that right?
Three songs, yeah.
And did you do all of those in that one session?
Yeah, it was just a magic moment, really. Like, you know, those kind of magic moments where everything is just fluid and smooth and connected. And yeah, so we've done all the three songs there. I left and was like, wow, that was it. But that was great. And and 6 months later, the album came out. And yeah, there was a big energy because, you know, he collaborates with a lot of other musicians, and in that room there were Mink also, another singer, and yeah. Elliot Power.
That's right.
So they are like two young rapper and singer.
Were they there in the same
session?
They
were there also, oh, okay, yeah, cool, yeah. We were three of us. And yeah, I guess, you know, this energy of him, James, and everyone there. So it's just been like good night. Connecting with other people, singing, jamming, because we were really jamming. I didn't think any of this will end up on the album. I thought we were just doing it as a demo, and then we'll do it in another studio. It was what I had in my mind.
And did he did it sound like it when you were recording it? Did mm-hmm. it sound like what was ended up on the record? Did he then, or did he take parts and reposition them?
No, I think straight away was like in. But and then we found out that we won't need to do it again. But I think at first he was thinking also that we redo it somewhere else because we were in a room like this one. So the acoustic, everything nice. Could have been, you know. But then they have like such a, like they are super not good and at post-production. So,
yeah.
You know. But that was great.
And this photos of you doing a session with Tony Allen, and is Brian Eno there doing the production?
Wow. Yeah. I mean, we did, I did 3 days with Brian.
Does Noel know that? Because, like, Brian Eno is such an absolute legend.
I don't know if Noel, there's Noel, actually.
He's like the kind of producer that comes up with the most incredible techniques.
Oh,
and,
I,
yeah,
I
he's
know.
Like the, yeah, yeah, yeah. So, like, yeah, I just...
Ooh.
Oh, it just fell down. Oh, that's
there's a ghost in the room.
Yeah, there is a ghost
that's
in the room.
That's when you talk about Brian Eno, what happened.
Yeah.
I mean, I've never
that's,
been...
That's to get the production technique.
I've never been impressed by anyone, really. Like, not in the way that... I'm not saying that as a, like, you know, arrogant way, or... I'm just saying that because I just think we're all humans, mm. and yeah, they are great human beings and great musicians, but I don't think because you are a great musician, you are a great human, sometimes not, true. You know? So I try to have the same respect for everyone, even for the people who, you know.
Did he do anything unusual in his production, or was it in his kind of direction to you guys? Do you remember?
He just asked me to scream. And at the time, I found it ugly, and he was like, I know what I'm asking for. And yeah, he just asked you to be yourself, you know, and just to be free, and then, but it's unreleased yet, so I can't wait for that to be released, because he does a lot of sessions like that at home, and hopefully they will end up somewhere to be released, because 3 days of a session with Tony Allen, Leo Abraham, another musician that is working a lot with, and another guy called Fred, very young guy at the time, who was playing machines. It was amazing, and you know, they got 12 hours in the computer of music.
Wow!
Out of those 3 days, so I really hope you will end up somewhere. And then I had another session with Brian, but out of the blue, in another time, I was going to meet this guy from XL Recordings, Richard Russell, who is like, you know, the boss for XL, and I was going to make him listen some of my music, and you know, just to have his mind and all that. Been lucky to know him through the Africa Express, so Damon Albarn's Africa Express.
Yeah.
And so I was in the. He just asked me before the meeting, Richard, to pass by his house. Sammy's got a studio when he usually does sessions, like maybe once every 2 months with musicians, great musicians. And then I arrived there. I didn't know who will be there, but there was Brian with, you know, he's building machines, so he's building. He has this pyramidal machines that he built himself. It's got thousands of buttons. You have no idea what it is for, but it's all about sound and music and like a texture. And this guy is a genius. So I'm not teaching that to you, but it's just, yeah, just I just arrived in the room and there's like one weird machine there and one weird machine there, and it's all like he's playing with it. So I arrived and Richard gave me like a voice, you know, a voice machine to just pitch my voice and enjoy. And I remember Brian was not even look. He was there maybe since an hour. He didn't even look who was in the room. I just started singing, so he could hear a female voice, but he didn't even look to know who. Was there. Really? It just kept going, and I just entered into the zone they were, and other musicians came. Like, I think we did that for 4 hours without even stopping or just, you know, having a cup of tea or anything. It was just a zone, total zone. And after 4 hours we stopped and everyone was like, hi, hello. Hi, oh hi, it's you. And that was one of the most beautiful moment of music I ever had in my life. Maybe I cannot say the one, but you know, that was incredible.
What about meeting Lauryn Hill? You've met her a few times, and have you worked with her, or is it just a case that your paths have crossed? Or
yeah, our paths cross all the time since I'm 19.
Really?
My first trip ever out of Paris was in Ethiopia, Addis Abeba, the capital. So I went to I was just arriving in Paris from Marseille, and I wanted to, you know, to do some music, and I've met in a rehearsal studio, met this guy called King, a Rastaman, white Rastaman with like super long dread, in a lift. And he asked me what I was doing, and I said, I'm with this new band. Like, I was just starting singing with a band in Paris. I would do anything, you know. I didn't care who they were. I just wanted to sing. So he said, oh, can I come and see? And I was just like, yeah, of course, no worries. So he came and then asked me to do some songs with him in his studio. So he had a studio in this place. And it was my first real time, I guess, being in a real studio with, you know, someone who was actually working with the Bob Marley Foundation.
Really?
Okay. Yeah, and it was like featuring with some amazing people, Tegan Jaffa Coley, actually Lauryn Hill, and a lot of music, great musicians, and was actually selling the compilation to give that money to some schools in Ethiopia. So it was a charity.
Great.
And so after 1 month of doing some stuff, he asked me if I wanted to go to Ethiopia with them, because there was a big concert from organized by the Marley family. So I was like, yes, great, let's do it. So it was my first ever trip, first festival. I was playing with him at this festival too.
Yeah.
So basically, yeah, my first gig was in front of 300,000 people.
What?
Yeah, that was the first ever real gig I had.
How did it differ from your expectations? So we've all been musicians who've wanted to play huge concerts like that.
Yeah.
When you first do that, and you know, you're playing to that many people, what surprised you? What was different to what you perhaps not dreamed of, but that thought it might be like?
Everything was different from what I could imagine, because
really?
It was beyond what I could have ever imagined. Like when I first arrived, Rita Marley was there. I basically started singing, like, by listening Bob and Ifri and Marcia Griffith, Rita Marley, and they were right there in front of me. Yeah, so it's my first time coming out from France, and I have those idols of me in front of me. Like, they were talking to me, and they were seeing, they came to me like if they knew me. Sometimes I was always like looking at my back, thinking that they were
speaking to someone behind you.
They were speaking to someone else, but they embraced me, like, and Lauryn did the same. Like, she had a conference, so we stayed there for 3 weeks in total. And so I was all around Bob mother, Bob mom, she's a poet, and she was at the hotel. She was reading some poetry, and you know, Rita was managing all the organization. Marcia was singing. I mean, it was a dream. All the sons were there, Steve, Julian, and then Lauryn was married to Steve at the time.
Oh.
And Steve Marley, they had 4 kids.
Right.
And so she was doing a conference, and that was the first time I would actually see her for real. So I went to meet her. I went to the conference, and then when she came out, a lot of journalists came to her, like dogs, really. When I've seen that, I was just like, oh my God, that's exactly what I don't want. You know, like, it was, they were so aggressive, like putting her the mic into her mouth, wanting something, you know, absolutely. So I was like that, a bit on my side, looking at it and being a bit disgusted, you know. And then I don't know how, somehow she came to me to escape them a bit, or I don't know. And she asked me my name, she asked me who I was, and I said, oh, I'm Audrey, and yeah, I'm a singer. It's my first time in Addis Ababa, and she said, "Okay, do you want to come with me into my room? I have this interview with two journalists, and yeah, come, you know." And I was like, "Really?" I mean, I could barely speak English, but this time I understood, and yeah, so that's me coming to, you know, with 4 kids and a manager and 2 journalists. Going to her room and then ending up like singing with her, Killing Me Softly, which she said, it's not from me, you know that. And I was just like, no, I didn't know. Roberta Flack was
there.
Yeah,
it was a cover, wasn't it? Yeah.
But anyway, that was a 3 hours moment, and we all ended up like with tears and of joy, because she's such a beautiful human being. Apart from the singer, she's got this aura, you know, that when she speaks, she's a superhuman. Whatever we think of her today, she's given something to the world.
Absolutely. Now, Tony Allen, godfather of Afrobeat, Brian Eno once said that Tony Allen was perhaps the greatest drummer who ever lived.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
You agree? Why is that? What makes him such a great such a great drummer?
I mean, being on stage with him for 4 years, he just realized that his consistency is the fact that he created his own patterns the teacher, when he was younger, were like, no, it's not this way, you gotta do that. And he was like, no, I can't do that. And he could have gone the other way and said, oh, yeah, okay, you want me to do that? Okay, I'm gonna forget about what I have. But he couldn't. He was like, he could, but he wouldn't do it. And I admire that, because he could have been thinking, oh, if I'm doing it my own way, then no one will hire me. So yeah, I should do like everyone else does. And he was like, he's always saying today, I'm happy I didn't, because, you know, I would be like one of these, I would be somewhere in America trying to, you know, to break with the same patterns as everyone else. Great. That's not my life, you know. So instead, he did the best with Fela, then created a genre that is still on and more than ever. It's more and more fashionable. Afrobeat is everywhere now, and he's still alive to share it with young people. I see him recording with like those 15 years old, and then, you know, every kind of electronic, hard electronic, every kind of music. He says that scientifically and mathematically, Afrobeat can be played with every single other genre.
Really?
Music. I mean, look at what he does with Damon,
yeah.
Albarn in...
The Good, Bad and Queen.
The Queen, you know, the last one been done with Tony Visconti. You can mix it, yeah, with everything. It's amazing.
And it's interesting, what I was thinking when you were talking about how he was rejecting kind of the ideas and people saying do things a certain way, and he came up and he was stubborn and he kind of went with his own ideas and created something new.
Yeah.
That kind of goes back to what you're talking about, like challenging pre-existing concepts on your psychology degree. It's just like, finish off that last year, because you might be as much of a genius around the world of psychology as he is around the world of drumming. Who knows? Okay.
No, but I don't need to finish the courses in that way. I can do.
You can do it in other ways.
In other ways, and I think it's what I'm doing already.
Good stuff. Now, is it true that Tony, at the beginning, never gave you lyrics? Tony Allen never gave you lyrics. Is that right? And so you could just, were you singing?
How do you know that?
Research.
Yeah, so, at the beginning he didn't. I mean, that was this first show where it was in somewhere in Algeria. There were like 10,000 people, jazz festival in Algeria. It was a country at the time where you can't go like that. You know, it's like it was difficult politically. And then I ended up there first show. It's like seven. I don't know him so much, so I think I'm a bit shy to go and ask him, well, what about the lyrics, you know, because the show is in 2 hours now, and you still haven't given to me. So I didn't dare to go and say, I didn't understand. I thought, you know, something, I don't know, I had no idea. Anyway, the guy is strange in the best way, but, you know, So I said, okay, so I have no lyrics now, you know, so what's going to happen? He said, be yourself, do whatever you want. And I'm like, what? For 2 hours? Whatever I want? I mean, that's... And then, yeah, that first show, I just improvised.
Mm.
And then at the end, he was like, okay, so if you've done that now, you can do anything. And then the next day, I got to have the lyrics and learn some songs. But... Yeah.
So when he hadn't given you the lyrics, did you know what the melody was going to be and you had to make up lyrics to a melody that existed, or was it a case that you had a blank canvas and could do whatever you wanted?
No, I couldn't really make up lyrics. I did what I could that day.
Wow.
But yeah, it's a jazz festival. There were a lot of improvisations. We were 12 in the band also, so there's like a lot of solos from everyone. So yeah, that was just about... It just taught me how to listen. That was the day where I had to learn how to listen everyone else, because, you know, nothing is prepared. There's no anticipation to have about what you're going to say, what you're not going to say, what you're going to sing, which height. And no, it's all about listening to everyone. And everyone has a room, so I was not the only one to have to fill the room. Everyone, you know, had to do something. Mm. So that was a challenge. Like, I was sweating, but... it was great. And then the next day, that was easy.
So, having been produced by Brian Eno, Tony Allen, and James Lavelle, if you were producing a singer, or doing a session with a singer, what would you do, having learnt from them, to get the best out of their performance?
Well, in a busy city, if I was in a busy city like we are, like London and all that, the first thing would be, yeah, the cup of tea for sure. talking about whatever, you know, and anything else but music at the beginning.
Why is that?
Just because I think it's just always good to remind each other that we're not here just to perform something, but we are just human beings and things happen in your day. So I don't know, the way you what happened into the underground, and I don't know, just, you know, some normal stuff, which Brian Eno did, and I was very surprised. He was talking NHS when I arrived, and his daughter was in Calais at the time, where there was all the migrants. So she came there for 3 months to help them.
Right.
I was so amazed by the fact that, yeah, he was also close to, you know, the ground and reality and down to earth, and I think that's a secret,
yeah,
to not just fly, because it's easy to fly where we are on stage, we are up there, we are up the people, up, always up, you know, being used to be served before, to have VIP, blah blah, VIP ticket, VIP, we don't queue, I mean, you know, in that world, so it's, yeah, easy to not walk on the ground anymore. So yeah, if I have a session with a young artist, I just remind her that, you know, I'm the same as her. We are all together, and then we're just gonna try to elevate through the music, but not, you know, we're not living in like elevation state all the time.
Cool. And what about their preparation and their would you just allow them to warm up their voice in their own way, or would you do it, because you've got an app, haven't you, that you warm up your voice with, is that right? You and Jess use an app to go through scales beforehand, is that not right?
No, I mean, Jess does it more than me.
Oh, okay, cool.
It's not the app, I mean, I have my own routine usually, and when Jess does it, I just do either, or not all the time, but you know, you've seen that video where nobody's talking about us warming up,
yeah,
and laughing at us, which I understand. It's weird noises anyway, because it has to go through all the, you know, textures, and also we have to warm up. So depending where you're coming from, if you just come out the plane, or you know, you're in different state all the time. But yeah. Yeah, I mean, everyone is free to do what he wants. Usually, you are warmed up before a session.
Yeah, that's true.
Ideally, if you're a professional.
That's true. you, in your solo career, yeah, you supported George Benson and Mary J. Blige, is that, yeah, right? Wow.
And like, Seal.
And Seal as well, wow, okay, cool. Talk us through some of the kind of highlights.
Voice to Men.
Voice to Men, really? Classic.
And TGT.
Really? Okay. So talk
and
us...
En Vogue.
Oh, really?
But that I don't think.
Okay. So, I mean, how do you... What are the challenges? I know you're going on a support tour now, but it's slightly different.
Yeah.
But what are some of the challenges when you're, you know, you're the support acts for George Benson or Mary J. Blige or some of those?
Yeah.
Is it difficult because some of the audience are going to be slightly disengaged and talking and not... What's your aim? What's a successful support slot? What's your aim in that session?
Receive potatoes. Yeah, I think if you can make it without potatoes or tomatoes, that's great.
Okay, so no one's throwing anything at you. But no one's throwing anything at you. Get
exactly,
it,
because, you know, you never know. Like, I don't know if it still happened, but I just make sure I am at like this level, like I just put it at the highest level I can, because I consider these artists so much, and I just want to do my best to get there, and to also for people to enjoy, because, you know, it's a support act, so people are still coming into the room, okay, but some people are here since the beginning and they want to see, some people came for me, some people are discovering, and they're still going to spend like 30 to 45 minutes with me. I just want to give the best, you know. Like, it's not because you're supporting that it's supposed to be just, you know, you need to make them dream. anyway. So yeah, it's been amazing. For my Radio Blaze, I was really scared because the
of
crowd.
What were you scared of?
Just this crowd of fanatic, like proper fans. They are dressed like her. They have the same haircut. They are and you know they have to listen to me before, so you need to give them the most you can, you know, the most love you can. And
did it change your approach in any way?
I might have changed the set list to make it to try and find the songs that will go into more into, you know, soul, R&B. But no, I think I've stayed close to me, to myself.
Great. Okay, so tell us how you got involved with Nolan.
Okay, so that ring that you see here.
Yeah.
So it's a tourmaline from Africa. I'm in Dalston Market on a Sunday, so East London.
Yeah.
And I'm hesitating to have to have this ring because, you know, it's been a year. Left from France, I'm not working yet, I've stopped everything I was doing in France, which was working with everyone. I was working there, I'm an actress, I've stopped everything for to come to London without knowing why, really. So it was the first year, and it was not easy at all, financially, at all. So I was looking at this ring that I really wanted, but, you know, I was like, this is the end of the month, might not be the best idea, and blah, 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 just thinking. And then this woman, she's a French woman, like around her 50s, she's looking at me, she sells it. She sells all those rings with all the stones. I love stones, so I'm like staying on this place and dreaming of all the rings I could buy. And then she's asking me what I'm doing, and I say, oh, I'm a singer, and I'm from France. Oh, yeah, me too. It's been 30 years she was here. And then she I don't know why, she said, okay, I have this friend. He was a manager, a tour manager. She doesn't really know, but he's a good friend of her, and he's called Arden Kleinman. And so she give me a number, and I'm like so focused on the ring that I don't really care. So I put the paper on my pocket and forget about it. Then finally don't take the ring, and she said to me, I have more at home, maybe come and pass by the house, let's have a tea, and then you can choose all the other rings you want. So I became friends. Until today we're really definitely close. And so I went back to her house 2 weeks after, and she was like, oh, did you call this guy that I gave you the number? And I was like, no, actually, I totally forgot. She said, oh, call him, you never know, you know? So I finally buy this ring, and 1 week later, I'm moving house, so I found the paper again. And I call the guy, and the other is like, I don't know you. You don't really know the other person that advised you to call me. I don't know what I can do for you. He hangs up. Oh. And yeah, I mean, you know, he's a bit of a, he's like super frank, super, you know, super nice, but super frank person. Now that I know him, I understand. Then he calls me back at midnight, around midnight, saying, I got something for you. I'm like, what? It's midnight, you get something for me. A few hours earlier, you were like, you didn't care at all. What's going on? And he said, I don't know. I mean, tomorrow, if you send me your address, I'll come and I will introduce you to someone. If you don't, you don't. And you will always wonder what it was about. So I was just like, okay, listen to your little voices. And yeah, I just sent my address. He came the next day with his big car, Mercedes, and brought me to Primrose Hill in a restaurant, very like chic restaurant, to see David Holmes. So I don't know who is David Holmes at the time. Mm-hmm. So I'm like literally going to the toilet and Google him because I have no idea really. So I realized that, you know, he's been working for so many, you know,
legend,
like legend, proper legend. and come back to the toilet like, hey. And he literally has 15 minutes because he's on his way to the airport, really. He lives in Belfast and he had spent a week there already. He was on his way back. So it's only because Arden is a really good friend of Wim that he went passed by the restaurant. Otherwise, he would have just gone straight to the airport. So basically, if
And had he heard you sing by that stage?
No, so nothing.
And even this guy on the phone hadn't heard you? Did they know that you played with Tony Allen? And
not yet.
No. Really?
No. It's just all about...
So you could have been anybody?
Anybody. Wow. A fan, a crazy person, anything. I don't know how, I don't know why. This is just so crazy. And then also, if I did have called... the week before or the week or the 2 weeks, if I would have called 3 weeks before, as soon as I got the paper, nothing would have happened because David Holmes was not in London. He lives in Belfast.
Yeah.
Arden would have been like not thinking about it at all. Nothing would have happened. So it was timing. And then we had this short lunch where David had to leave 15 minutes after. He's looking at me like really deep and I'm like, okay, but everything looks super sane and everyone is super nice. And I'm like, wow, it feels like I found a team of people, nice people for the first time in London. That's cool. And at the same time, I don't know why I'm here for, and he still doesn't tell me. Still don't tell me. So I he just tell me before he leaves, I need your music when I arrive back in Belfast, so in 3 hours. So I'm like, oh my god, I'm gonna have to assemble like all the demos I have, which I had a few things that I've done in London with my friend Simbad, who has a studio, and I've done a lot of late nights with him, like, you know, writing for who we don't know, but just your, you know, writing. Because there is this thing of, you know, sometimes you're writing, you're doing a lot, you have no idea if it's going to end up somewhere, but you still have to have the same passion anyway. So, yeah, remember doing it and remember doing some beats with Damon Albarn also, because as a part of the Africa Express, he wanted to help me, and so he put some of the keyboards, of his keyboards in my demos, which helped definitely sounding better. So I could send that to David, and 15 minutes later I think I received an email saying an email with David copy and Noel Gallagher saying welcome on board. And I'm like, Noel Gallagher? You know, I come from France, so I know him, of course. I know Aziz, of course. But I don't really know what he's doing in my emails, you know. And I'm like, yeah, okay, so what do you mean? Welcome on board of what? Because he still didn't tell me he was producing. So I'm like, is it the Noel Gallagher or is it someone else? I mean, you want me to work with, I don't understand. And he's sending me this email back saying, I'm producing the next album for Noel Gallagher and you'll be a part of it if you want. See you next week in the studio, make the most of it. I'm like, all right. And that's how he started.